Hey, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this is From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Our episode has two parts. It's a conversation as well as a guided meditation. We're connecting you to a variety of contemplative teachers, hearing their story, as well as sharing a meditative practice. If you don't have time right now to hear Amakai's story, you can take a look at the show notes for when the meditation portion begins, and just feel free to skip ahead and come back later to the conversation. We've also learned from our earlier episodes that there's this challenge between moving between the passive participation of listening to a podcast and then the sitting work of guided meditation. And since we're really about you getting a practice going, we've released those practice portions as a pocket practice all on its own that you could download later as a separate, shorter, easy to share podcast episode. Today we talk with Rabbi Amakai Lau Levi, who directs Lab Shul in New York, which is this place that's this intersection of performance theater and ritual and this kind of open space to practice the old story of the Torah and through that telling to begin to build community. It was a fascinating conversation about the as if of community. What is it like for community to be a place that leaves the openness for possibility, and how do you perform that as a community? You could be doing a million different things right now, maybe making a homemade candle or waxing your car, or probably around this time of year raking some leaves. That said, why not just stop and take a look around you? Take a couple deep breaths and enjoy listening in. Hopefully you'll be able to sit and meditate with us in the second half. Well, today we are with Amakai Lau Levi, and we have it's a real trip to have you here at From the Hive, Amakai.
I'm happy to be buzzing all the way from New York City.
There we go.
Being with you.
Thanks. We you do quite a few things, but in particular we met gosh, I don't think it was probably a good 10 years ago or more, in a conversation between rabbis and pastors and community organizers, kind of thinking about the future of spirituality. And now you are, now since that time, you've started Lab Shul, and you have been ordained in the rabbinate. And so a lot of things have happened, and your work is this beautiful intersection in the conversations we've had, this beautiful intersection of the work of theater and art, as well as the work of spiritual formation and identity and a number of those things. Would you mind kind of just helping us kind of get the lay of the land about what a average week is like for you and a little bit of what Lab Shul is like right now?
Well, average is a funny word. But, you know, my journey is one that is, I think, typical for many in today's ecosystem, where we are finding ways into spirit and into consciousness, not necessarily through the true and tried ways of our ancestors, but through a mix and match of various tools and various tales and various techniques. I grew up Jewish in a very Orthodox community in Israel and found my way into Jewish and other spiritual expressions that really focused on storytelling and how the ways we tell our stories, what stories we choose to tell, how we talk back to the stories we've inherited, help chart our path. And then from the story, from the legend, we literally go onto the map of walking our talk and finding ways to be grounded and to be spirited and to be helpful. So my journey led me from Israel to the United States, where I was involved with theater in New York City and looking for ways to do storytelling, ritual, and ritualize storytelling in very site-specific contexts, in houses of worship and in libraries and civic squares. And that theater company, Storahtelling, where we took the Torah, the old scriptures, and made them into political theater, became a community of practitioners and artists and friends and fans. And a decade later, the community of like-minded aspiring seekers became a congregation, primarily Jewish, but not only, grounded in Jewish wisdom, but speaking to the various needs and voices of today. And so Lab Shul, as a lab, and Shul is a German Yiddish word for school, but also for that little schoolhouse, for the sense of a one-room hub where the life of the spirit and wisdom happens. So Lab Shul is an experiment in how do we come together in this day and age and generate the sense of responsibility to the sacred path and to each other that so many of us are yearning for. Technically, Lab Shul right now is 5 years old as a congregation. I've been a rabbi officially for the last 2 years. We have a team of 10 people who are working in the office and many more volunteers. And it's hard to say what average is, but we create ritual worship events. We create study events. We do a lot of social and civic justice work. We're increasingly serving people's life cycle needs, from baby namings, we got one coming this Saturday, mm-hmm. to coming of age bar mitzvah ceremonies. And we got four coming up this month, to people's death moments and people's heartbreak moments, and weddings and divorces. So it's become a really interesting experiment in using story and using art and using a very open spiritual path to invite people into presence. And the one last thing I'll say is that we are catering and we're supporting and we are inviting a lot of people for whom religious life and faith are not givens. They are aspirations. There may be memories or maybe hunches. And we are simultaneously building up the vocabulary of what it means to have a spiritual life guided by Jewish tradition, but also to make it very applicable and malleable to who we are today, which is nothing like what we were 100 years ago. That was a lot.
We're going to have a blast here. So I'll just point out some of the pairings that you put together that I think is going to be a really fun place to chase this. So, it just in that kind of walk in the perimeter of this, to pair together experiment and ritual, most of us see one as being very open-ended and potentially volatile and one being closed and predictable. Another one you put together was open and presence, and then you put together aspiration and faith and hunch and spirit. So I'm kind of noticing a trend here, the way that you're holding what a lot of us have experienced as a dichotomy or a paradox. You're holding that paradox and saying, like, it sounds to me like that really names the character of the community, that there is something that our minds want to domesticate as being sturdy and confined, and then these other qualities of life that are open and fluid. So, am I onto something there?
You know, there is, there's a quote that I've used a lot, and it's sort of at the cornerstone of everything we do at Lab Shul, which is by Rabbi Cook, who was a really interesting mystic and a leader in the early 20th century. And he wrote, the old will become new and the new will become sacred. Hayashan yitchadesh v'achadash yitkadesh. And that really is the invitation, right? How do we take the ancient, the inherited, the traditional, the as-is, make it applicable to now, and then make the new equally sacred?
Yeah.
And I think the way to get from as was to as is through the as if. That's where metaphor comes in. That's where art comes in. That's what's saying, look, we get why we gather for Sabbath. We get why we open the scroll and read from the Torah. We get why we invite you into a meaningful moment of celebration or mourning, as our ancestors have for centuries. But some of the language might not work. Some of the assumptions might not work. Some of the liturgy might seem bizarre. And so we're looking for a way to translate the ancient into the modern and not lose the balance between baby and bathwater. Mm-hmm. That is inherently about fusions and about hybrids. And I think that quote and this dedication to the art of hybrid is very much at the core of where I think we are as a species mm-hmm. at this moment. And that's certainly where I am, and certainly I think some of us in the Jewish world and in other spiritual domains are privileged to be able to have enough of where we come from, but also our eye on the future that requires these fusions.
So
this, you know, mix and match.
Yeah. Remix. This is it. So the hybrid, that fusion, for a lot of folks, the different conversations we've had from the Hive are around, where does the lineage inform your practice, and how does your practice interact with your work? Like, how do you sustain your work through practice? And so we're, in some sense, this is a desire to kind of re-enliven the conversation of what is a practice. But what I hear you saying about that importance of that hybrid is that the practice, that improv is always happening, that there is the old, that you're challenged to kind of go, how does it become new? And then there's this question of how does the new become sacred? So I'd be curious, in your own life, what would be a practice or two that you've had that you've been handed, that you've then, in a sense, translated? And then the third part of the question would be, so you're handed it, and then now this is how you translate it. And then the third part of the question would be, how does that, in fact, help you sustain this work of organizing and leading an organization the size that you just described?
That's a big question.
Yeah. Well, we can take it a piece at a time. I mean, but I am interested in how practice stabilizes you or inspires you in your work. But to work backwards from what you were saying, some of it would be like, where did that practice even come from? Do you notice where it came from through your tradition?
So I'll take an example that was the core of the theater company that I created in 99 that is now very much at the core of how Lab Shul gathers and ritualizes our stories and our myths and our legacies. So there is a tradition that goes back 2,500 years that is recorded in detail in the Bible, in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 8, which is how we proclaim scripture, how we read the Bible out loud. And it happened for the very first time 2,500 years ago in Jerusalem with Ezra and Nehemiah, mm-hmm. bringing out a scroll, which in the 5th century BCE was a big deal, reading out loud the first official version of the Torah, of the Bible as we know. And then because people did not understand Hebrew at the time, they spoke Aramaic and the Torah was written in Hebrew, they introduced the Mevinim, the Mavens, who translated the Torah line by line, we think, into vernacular, and in effect created the complicated and beautiful dance between the written and the spoken, the written Torah and the spoken Torah, the literal and the oral, the PDF and the Google Doc, and of the day. That was the way Torah was proclaimed in public spaces for 1,500 years, including notable passages in the New Testament where Jesus is part of this ritual. People stand up and proclaim the scriptures, and they interpret and they translate. That tradition died out about 1,000 years ago, and when I started storytelling as a theater company that focuses on reliving the ritual of how we tell Torah in public space, it was about reimagining that profession of the maven, the translator, and making that event when scripture happens in public, if it's a sanctuary or school, a public celebration, that we actually bring back the translation. We bring back the storytelling hour as a way to talk back to the text, to reimagine our relationship with scripture. And what of the quotes we agree with and what do we have trouble with because we've evolved. And in essence, combine, again, fuse this notion of education and entertainment and theater and religion that people feel invited into the text as thinkers, as speakers, as commentators, as people who live scripture. That is at the core of the storytelling method. It is at the core of how every time when LabShul meets and we introduce scripture, we have trained over the years dozens of people to be these mavens, to be these translators. So it's an ancient practice that has been forgotten and has been brought back so that we can empower people with literacy, with biblical knowledge, and with a permission to interpret, to talk back, to think out loud, how does tradition speak to our needs today? So this is very much dear to my heart. I'm hoping to spend some time in the next 2 years finally writing my book about this method and make it a toolbox that can be used by clergy of all faiths and educators and artists to come to grips with our complicated legacy of scriptures. So that's beautiful. I hope that helps.
It's a great example. So you take the practice of the mevanim and you take the you root it in a community who's holding the text and in a sense put the ritual agency on the community to come to grips with and to re-enliven that text. Tell me as a where would that get a little more specific as to how this involves the body, how this involves kind of risk or openness. A lot of us, and I'll just say this in particular, like my own experience from a type of Protestantism that would have what's called a sermon. Typically, this is something that's listened to, that somebody else wrote, and it doesn't it stays in headspace most typically, and I think there's more you're saying, so I'd like you to push a little more for folks to hear, like, what is it that happens in that exchange that you're describing? How does it involve the gathered people?
Right. So the way we do it, and this is where the theatrical comes in, is very avant-garde theater. Everybody's rolled in the story. So, for instance, I was at a rehearsal earlier today with a family where their 13-year-old son is about to be coming of age. His rite of passage, is his bar mitzvah, is centered around an episode from the Torah scroll that will be read out loud. This kid is not going to chant the Hebrew. He wrote the script, the Maven script. Mm-hmm. And the story that he's dealing with that in a couple of weeks will be Abraham haggling with God over the destruction of Sodom. Mm-hmm. If you remember the story, Abraham goes to God and says, if there's 50 good people there, will you not destroy the city? And they go down to 40, 30, 20, 10. And then finally God says, you know, there's 10, maybe. And then Sodom ends up being destroyed. This kid focused on the art of negotiation. What does it mean to negotiate? Can we negotiate for the better? Can we find favor and righteousness where otherwise the situation is one that is not? But really, how does one negotiate better? That's what this kid was interested in. And so he's rolling the entire audience, it's going to be his family and friends and community, as people who are trying to help Abraham win Sodom. And he is, he's Abraham. And so at some point he's going to turn to everybody and say, am I negotiating well enough? How would you negotiate better? How do we get God to not destroy Sodom? And what he's really going to talk about is how do we get God to not destroy our planet? What can we do? How do we negotiate with ourselves, with each other, with God? So, and people just are going to throw answers. It so happens that this kid's grandfather apparently wrote the book on the art of negotiation back in the 70s. Fantastic. You know, his dad is going to stand up and say, by the way, here's the book. Your grandfather wrote the book. And it's sort of planned, but also going to be improv.
Yeah.
So it's a way for everybody to feel like, oh, we are part of creating the story. We're part of understanding what about the story speaks to our lives. And that's just one example. Over the High Holy Days, we brought in the story of Adam and Eve and the two versions of creation, both the egalitarian one and the non-egalitarian one. And people were sort of challenged to think about that as Eve, as an Adam. And the second day, we had the story, on Yom Kippur, we had the story of the sacrificial rituals of atonement and ask, like, what is the role of sacrifice in today's reality when we don't sacrifice goats? How do we embody sacrifice? And people talk back. They talk to the whoever's leading. They talk to each other. They walk away with questions. So it embodies the scriptures in ways that are resonant with our modern human needs. It isn't about Jewish and it isn't about faith. It's about being human and using stories to help us chart our ethics, our morals, and our values.
Beautiful.
It's pretty powerful. And yeah. And it could be very funny. Like, it really depends on the story.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But you're basically, you're part of a interactive storytelling.
So that's terrific. I'm curious how, as I was asking a question about personal practice, you got into community practice. And I think that this, we could decide to chase this a couple different directions, but I was recently with someone talking about three-centered knowing and making some comparisons that that many different traditions kind of center on a certain area for practice. And so the way she described it is that from the head center, the wisdom of Buddhism gives us a way of kind of understanding what is open-mindedness, what is the practice of practicing from our mind. And heart center, so many of the Christian icons have these kind of the sacred heart, this notion that there's an interaction that's taking place around where passions and compassion resonate. And then body center being similar to Judaism and Islam, that in different ways they each are kind of very rooted and incorporating how does our practice, like my friend Miriam, a rabbi here in town, she's like, I just want to know like why this matters. So how is this going to play out in what we're doing in the city? How's this going to play, like some very physical, tangible things? So your answer about practice was very community. It's what people do together. What's your response to that? Do you think is that in fact the case, that there's something just naturally really communal about practice? Are there some practices that you find work in isolation and solitude? What's your experience of that?
I hear you. I think that the ritual I went to, which is so dear to my heart, is this collective storytelling. And I think it is done best when together we get to echo each other, witness each other, hear each other, look each other face to face, and walk into the Holy of Holies together. And that is the power of story. And of course, in today's age, you can stay home and watch the latest movie on Netflix, or you can go to the movies and watch it with other people. And there's an interesting debate of like, what is it that is happening as we shift from these public spaces into the more private? What are we gaining? What are we losing? Yeah. Storytelling and theater and Torah aside, what I cherish when we gather for worship together with beautiful music and meditations and words to guide us is that we are very publicly private and very privately public together. I'm known as a weeper. Like, I get on stage and we start leading whatever worship it is, and the music and the intention, and wherever we are, and if my heart is in the right place, I start weeping, mm-hmm. or at least crying. And people are no longer freaked out by that, and I am not either. But it means that I'm allowed and I'm enabled, and I'm enabling people to be private publicly. Because when we come together for our soul needs, there's what to cry for ourselves, for our loved ones, for our community, for our country, for the world. And whether we are moved with joy or we're moved with grief, we move. There's movement. And the courage or the compassionate ability to be publicly private with my emotions is something that I think in this society is not frowned upon, but it's a little weird. Or people are not always so used to it. I'm talking about some of the American Western and some of the Jewish Western as well. But the invitation to be publicly private and to close my eyes and really go into my needs, my joys, my contemplations, my gratitudes, and know that the person next, you know, in the chair next door or across the aisle is doing the exact same thing. And I'll never know what they're thinking about, but we're doing it together. That simple private public act of prayer is so known to us in our DNA. It's like in our hard drive. Mm-hmm. And yet I feel like part of my job is to give people the permission to reclaim it.
That's extraordinary.
And for myself as well.
The we'll use Peter Block's work quite a bit around the hive, and he'll talk about it as confronting people with their freedom, and that this is that invitation into conversation is to say, like, you're free to engage this. What are you going to do with it? Which sounds like that, you know, that image that you're giving of making the private public. To be privately public, and publicly private, that resonates.
We're a lab, so even though we're sitting on the shoulders of thousands of years of Jewish contemplative and intellectual history and community building, we're trying out something else because so many of people who are with us are potentially Jewish, but not informed of the Jewish ways, because of the, you know, the lag in transmission of the last couple of centuries, and or the people who were not born Jewish and did not join the Jewish community, but are living with other Jews and are curious about the spiritual path, and they might come from a faith-based tradition or not. So we're catering to a community that, unlike a few generations ago, one cannot assume is on the same page and is connected to the same narratives and the same sacred truths. There's a yearning, but there's not necessarily a buy-in. So it requires and behooves us to be really very flexible and very elastic in how we invite people in.
So you mentioned the different ways that people have buy-in, and I heard you say before that there's yearning without buy-in, and that working from that space and that there's a play there with what we conventionally understand faith to be. And just share a little bit about that with me, how that plays out, that there's yearning and you participate in that while there isn't necessarily buy-in, and how you either curb around that and honor that at the same time.
One of the discoveries that I've made in my own life and living here in the United States is that people are very cautious of the G word, of God.
Mm-hmm.
People want spirit. People feel a yearning to connect to something bigger, especially at moments of crisis and in moments of great celebration. But God is baggage. God is loaded, G-O-D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will speak for the Jewish world, not for the extensive European, Western, global reality, but I think the transition that we're seeing from patriarchy to whatever we're moving into, the suspicion after several centuries of enlightenment and science and the grappling between the various fundamentalistic and progressive viewpoints, that people want spirit, they want soul, they want to be connected, but they're suspicious and maybe even weary of capital G God.
Mm-hmm.
That is certainly true for the Jewish world and for the Jewish liberal world. And so my attempt has been to not just translate spirit and vocabulary into a more modern, accessible idiom, but to also explore what it's like to have the sense of the divine as an open metaphor, to invite people to explore their relationship, our relationship to each other, to the sacred, in ways that don't immediately have knee-jerk suspicion and autopilot liturgical quotations.
Yeah.
So at Lab Shul, we have God optional as one of our taglines, alongside everybody friendly and artist driven. Now, God optional is wink, wink, but basically we're saying it's optional. You can be here on the Day of Atonement on a Sabbath morning or at a, you know, a funeral or a baby naming ritual, and we're going to be singing prayers and we're going to be chanting hymns and we're going to be in meditation. We'll be telling stories. You can consider the notion of God as a metaphor. There is a greater force. There is a soul within. It's your higher power. It is universe. It is Mother Earth. It is whatever works for you that indicates the sense of being part of something bigger without the implied assumptions of I believe in God, in a God, and therefore I am compelled to observe and obey and be in communication with that higher power. For a lot of people, that is not a given. I believe we need scaffoldings and we need baby steps to bring people into a life of affirmation of the sacred. And a lot of my work is about triage, is about first aid, to give people just a sense that there is something going on. There is a life of the spirit. The Jewish community and other communities have cultivated the poetry of contemplation for many, many generations. Some of those poems seem archaic and irrelevant. Some of them are relics that still resonate today. And in this mix and match, people are invited to make sense of their own journey. Because one thing is for sure, we are yearning to be part of something bigger. Mm-hmm. The individualistic, urban, industrial, digital, narcissistic, all about me is not working. It probably never did. And we've got tools. We've got toolboxes. We've got traditions. Some of them are useful. Some of them are not. But core value, the core value proposition is that we're here to hold each other accountable and that we've got ways to tap deeper into soul and into body and into connection and into sacred. I find people very, very thirsty for that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. That yearning is palpable. Hmm.
And problematic, because we see how fundamentalism on all sides is speaking on the name, you know, the name of God, and drowns out our best intentions. So people get upset and walk away. I'll give you a very quick, weird example.
Yeah.
This past Sunday, and this is political, so feel free to cut it out. But this past Sunday night, there was a rally held by several organizations in New York City, including the Muslim Community Network, and a few different churches, and Lab Shul and others, in front of City Hall to protest the upcoming reissuing of the so-called Muslim ban. Mm-hmm. The administration's move to ban 7 countries from admitting its citizens into this country. Of them, many are Muslim, etc. So clerics and faith leaders and social activists gather. There were about a few hundred of us of all religions. And there was one woman who sort of came, the big American flag, who was against this gathering and who kept praying out loud again and again, shouting really the Lord's Prayer as a way to drown out the
perfect
imams
example.
And the rabbis and the other ministers. And it was just one woman. We were mic'd. She was not, but her presence was persistent. And at one point, there was a woman from Somalia who asked for a moment of silence because that was the day where there was a huge bomb in Mogadishu and hundreds of Somalians were killed, including family members that she hasn't heard of yet. So we went into a moment of silence. In the middle of that moment of silence, this woman's insistent Lord's Prayer was just painful.
Mm-hmm.
Just painful. So disrespectful. Such a disgrace in the name of God. Mm-hmm. And I walked over to her and I said, ma'am, can I just, I know you're coming from a good place and I believe you're praying with a full heart, but right now your prayer is hurting people who are silent in the memory of people, innocent lives taken. It doesn't make a difference if they're Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or other. Human beings, can you please stop? And she looked at me and started screaming, harassment, harassment, you're harassing me. At least it got her to stop for a couple of minutes, and the moment of silence was at least preserved. But it just got us to really think about, so many people in our various religions are using the divine and using prayer and using religion for harm instead of for good. And so for those of us who care about the life of spirit, we have not only the triage to those who are looking for spirit, but for those who are battered and so exhausted and suspicious of what religion has to offer. And it's a simultaneous, at least dual loyalty to the past and to the present and to the ones who want to be, to believe that there's something here, and the ones who are just really wounded.
Yeah. And so much of the egoic structure we use to protect those wounds are what we have to, is what, it's almost the I wouldn't say the price of admission, but it's the very thing that you have to open back up in order for the tears to come, in order for the to be opened. That one of my teachers would say that don't break faith with your newly awakened heart. This is what you're talking about, is that like as the heart begins to awaken, then those defenses come down, and then there's something in us that goes, but I need to protect myself. And that tension between staying open, welcoming transformative possibilities, while also not, in a sense, forgetting or not neglecting those other misused terms for God in places that like you have to acknowledge where there still is power being used unfairly. You have to acknowledge with that, even with that woman, regardless of her stance, just simply the ability to disengage for a moment and just be present. That was a big ask of her as well, because we're using these, we get kind of stuck in these places where we find ourselves using these categories to provide some type of safety. I think it's just beautiful the way you're describing faith community that's willing to take those steps to not simply create a space of safety. It might be a sidetrack, but the recently at a event with spiritual entrepreneurs, and they were talking about some work that Jennifer Bailey and Mickey Scott Bay Jones and others have done, talking about not just safe space, but something stronger like brave space being a better image. And it sounds like that's what, that's a different type of promise. We're here together to make brave space, as opposed of that honors the yearning as well as the hesitation, to say this is a type of brave space. This has been fantastic. I hope we get to keep doing this. Before we take a break and come back, I'd love that if you'd offer a little bit of context on how, what type of practice you'll be leading us through.
Now that we've had this chat, I think what I'd like to lead us with is sort of my morning practice. There's like a morning meditation that I've developed. I can't reproduce over audio the props that I use that are some of the Jewish ritual props, but they're almost incidental. It is the intentional contemplative direction, and it's also grounded in an interpretation of one of the Psalms. And so if that's okay, I'd like to open by sharing a couple of moments of reading my version of Psalm 131, and then just walk us through a very simple four-step meditation, which has to do with our gratitude, with our wonder and appreciation, with our acknowledgement of what's broken, and with our pleading for what and how we can be part of the solution.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, Amakai, thank you so much for this conversation, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Great.
You bet. Hey there, you've been listening to From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. I'm your host, Troy Bronsink, the founder and director of The Hive, a center for contemplation, art, and action. We're located in the North Side neighborhood of Cincinnati, And after nearly 2 years of over 3,000 tickets to classes and events sold, we're announcing a move to a membership-based registration. For $30 a month, a Hive member can attend unlimited classes and events. If you're interested in this for yourself or interested in sponsoring somebody else in the Cincinnati area to become a Hive member, you can find more details at cincyhive.org/membership. Well, we're back with Amakai Laulavi, and it's just been great talking with you, man.
Thank you, brother. Not often that I get the chance to think out loud and to reflect on the path and the ways in which the path unfolds, and especially with siblings of faith from across the country. So I hope this becomes a face-to-face and not just a voice-to-voice.
Yep, absolutely. We'll make that happen again. We're going to just kind of hand the mic to you for a little bit to help folks center in for a practice. So I invite you to maybe tell folks a little bit about where you're sitting and kind of get them into their bodies and senses. And I'll actually put my mic on mute and let us go from here.
Okay. So there's this awareness that meditation, the simple act of sitting, breathing, observing, reflecting, going inside, is an Eastern practice that has become very popular. And it occurred to me some years ago that within the Jewish tradition, there are very similar contemplative paths and tools, and that some of them are hidden within plain sight. And one of those techniques for the type of contemplative meditation that I have now embraced as a morning practice is in the Psalms, and specifically Psalm 131, that is oddly translated in most of the English translations, is an instruction for how to wean one's soul and to drop into a space of individuation within what we call meditation, what in Hebrew we call contemplation, or shiviti, the sense of equanimity, to come into a place of inner balance. So I will read the English translation of the first two lines of Psalm 131, and then just meditate step by step through a four-step method that I've taken to really appreciate to start my day. So the translation, I'm looking at the King James here, a song of ascents to David. O Lord, my heart is not proud, nor my look haughty. I do not aspire to great things or to what is beyond me. But I have taught myself to be content like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child am I in my mind. So I'd like to offer a different translation. A song of ascents, written by David. O divine creator, my heart is not soaring, nor my eyes seeing the great mysteries. I would not have been able to be here, embarking upon mysteries, had I not taught myself how to contemplate, how to practice equanimity, had I not silenced my soul, as the weaned child sitting upon the mother, so is my soul weaned upon me. And the image here is a baby sitting upon the mother, a weaned baby, no longer nursing, individuating, separate from the mother, but still sitting in the mother's lap. So it is, says David, when I meditate, I am sitting here quietly, and I'm aware of the fact that there's an ego, there's a mind, there are the thoughts, and there's the soul, there's the being, there's the deep sense of me. And to meditate, to contemplate, to create this equanimity, is to drop into this understanding that I am this mother whose child is weaned. There is the soul, there is the mind. And the work of spiritual practice is to drop into this consciousness and deeper into the soul and distinguish ourselves from the constantly running stream of thoughts, which is the mind. So with that verse in mind, I want to sit with us quietly for a few minutes and walk step by step through four steps of contemplation. I'm sitting in my office. There are people in the hallway outside talking, and yet I invite wherever you are to be able to tune out and then tune in. So we start off just by sitting, being aware of the privilege of sitting, feeling our feet on the ground, feeling the ground through our shoes, socks, carpet, floor, no matter what floor we're on, feeling the gravity of ground. And then feel it through our body. Feel what it's like to be aware of our spine, of how exactly we're sitting. Be aware of the weight of the head and how the head is held. Be aware of our hands, our palms, our elbows, where are they in relation to our body? Just observing, making sure we're sitting comfortably. And with that, bring awareness to the breath. Not correct it, not perfect it. Just be aware of air coming in, going out. Just watching our nostrils, bringing in, going out. And just sitting here for a few seconds, maybe count to five in-breaths and out-breaths without losing the disciplined awareness. Thoughts come in, graciously acknowledge the thoughts, the noises. It's okay, come back to breath. Just breath in, breath out. And the first stop, now that we're a little more grounded and present, is gratitude. Every day, start by thanking. It's the first line on my lips when I wake up in the morning. I am grateful. In Hebrew, modeh ani. What am I saying thank you to? What is and is worthy of gratitude? And that's just an invitation to let whatever emerge. Someone's face, a flavor from yesterday, an expectation for today, this very moment, just letting gratitude guide this moment. Sometimes even difficult things come up. The face of someone with whom I'm having discord at the moment. Gratitude. So that I can learn how to be a better listener and be a peacemaker. Starting each day with gratitude just grounds us in what is and removes our instinct to focus on what is not. Keeping my breath, watching my breath, sitting straight, I gradually move from gratitude to the next stop on this morning train. And this is wow. wonder, praise. Hallelujah. Wow. What am I in awe of today? What is a source of wonder? What in my life right now brings out a wow? Just let it be. See what shows up, who shows up. If we are all made in divine image, the divine awe shows up in so many ways. A movie I just saw that blew me away. An art piece that a kid made sitting on my desk. The sky at this particular moment. Courage that I just witnessed. How is my life made better by focusing on wow? Just one fragment of wonder and amazement, appreciation. What is wonderful? And even just mouthing the word wow is like a massage to our face. Who am I going to say wow to today? And for what? Watching my breath, noticing my presence, I move from the thanks and the wow to the oops. Where does it hurt? What right now is weighing on me that needs fixing? In my own body, in my own home, in my soul, in my family, in whatever I consider community. Without judging, without assessing, what pops up? What's an oops? What needs fixing today? What can I do today? Let our mind, let our soul bring up the oops. That is calling for me today. Just watch, listen, be present, keep breathing. Maybe it's an email in my draft inbox that's been waiting. Maybe it's a phone call. Maybe it's taking the pants to be fixed. Maybe it's giving that hug. Maybe it's calling my congressman. Whatever it is, one thing I can do today is to handle the oops. That is imperfection. Keep on breathing, feeling the tightness that comes when we start letting the oopses in. Breathing gently. Taking a deep breath now. As we move to the fourth direction, moment, intention, and that is please. Move from the thanks to the wow, to the oops, to the please. Asking for help. How can I be part of the solution and less part of the problem? This is where we turn to our soul, to the soul of souls, to our higher being. To the great creator, asking for help, silently within, please. What do I need today to be able to be better, to be me, to be helpful, to rise? Just asking for help. With one more deep breath, aligning my soul, my mind, my body, my gratitude, my wow, my oops, and my please. And return to the psalm that reminds me to be equanimity driven, to silence myself, to listen within, to wean myself from the ceaseless mind, to be present deeper. Simply be. And when I'm ready, I open my eyes, smile at the world, start again, and begin my day.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've never done this out loud.
Well, it's beautiful to be guided through it, so I'm glad we did that today.
Thank you. Thank you for guiding me through it.
Yeah. Amakai Laulavi, thank you for your courage, for the example from the work you do, for your inventiveness, and just for this time to listen together and to be invited into the story that you're making. So thanks so much, man.
Thank you, my brothers. And may we really work together, play together, sit together, vision together, often and soon.
Yeah, that'll be great. There'll be much more.
Blessing.
Much more to come. As we wrap up here, there'll be show notes where folks can look and see more of what Amakai has to offer. And if you're in the New York area to know more about Lab Shul. Thank you so much for your time, and look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you for your beautiful work and for this beautiful invitation.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
To be continued. To be continued. Peaceful days.
Here we go.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
I'm Troy Bronsink, and this has been From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Today, we've been talking with Rabbi Amakai Laulavi. Check out the show notes for ways you can connect to his work, and be on the lookout for the pocket practice, a shorter version of this later in the week. From the Hive is a production of Joey Taylor.
Hey, thanks for listening, and take a breath and enjoy the day.